It breaks my heart, said Emma, because I love animals so much, not to mention the damage it's done to the car. About opening a piano bar, she promised she'd think it over. Joe Odom, who had known Emma all his life, often came to hear her wherever she happened to be performing. At some point after his arrival, Emma would play Sentimental Journey, which was the signal for Joe to come up and take over at the piano so she could rest a few minutes. Joe would happily oblige. The night Emma collided with her 10th deer, she drove to Whispers and played Sentimental Journey as soon as Joe set foot in the door. "Go out and see how bad the car is, Joe, will you?" she said. "I can't bear to look at it myself." 6 months later, she and Joe opened a piano bar in an old cotton warehouse overlooking the river. They called it Emma's. Emma's was a long, narrow room, cozy as a book-filled den. Its tiny dance floor was nestled in the curve of a baby grand piano. A picture window looked out on the river and on an occasional container ship gliding by. Dozens of framed photographs of family and friends lined the shelves along one wall, and an alcove by the entrance was decorated with memorabilia of Johnny Mercer. It was Mercer, in fact, who had nicknamed Emma the Lady of 6,000 Songs. That was how many songs she knew, according to Mercer's calculations. He and Emma had paged through a pile of songbooks, Mercer checking off the songs Emma could sing from start to finish. After 3 years of checking off songs, Mercer made an educated guess as to the store of lyrics in Emma's head. He put it at 6,000. The first time I came to Emma's, I was just taking my seat when Emma looked in my direction and asked, "What's your favorite song?" My mind went totally blank, of course. As I looked at her helplessly, a huge freighter came into view over her left shoulder. "Ship," I said. "My ship has sails that are made of silk." "Oh, that's a lovely song," said Emma. "Kurt Vile, 1941. She played it, and from that time on, Emma always played "My Ship" whenever I came into the bar. "Bartenders know customers by the drinks they order," she said. "I know them by the songs they ask me to play. Whenever regulars walk in the door, I like to play their favorites. It tickles them and makes them feel their home." Emma had many regulars. There were the four ladies from Estill, South Carolina, who drove in several nights a week with or without their husbands. There was the real estate agent, John Thorson, who walked his dog every night before going to bed and more than once kept walking until he got to Emma's, where, dressed in pajamas and bathrobe and accompanied by the dog, he was shown to his regular table. Just as he was sitting down, Emma would play "Moments Like This," which was his favorite song. There was Wanda Brooks, a self-appointed greeter hostess who wore rakish hats and a rhinestone brooch that advertised her telephone number in glittering numerals an inch high. Wanda had been a majorette in junior high school. Now she sold tanning beds to suntan parlors in South Carolina and coastal Georgia. She would call out, "Hey!" to perfect strangers, show them to a table, engage them in animated conversation, dance with them, and then move on to chat with others. Wanda was forever foraging in her purse for a lighter, swaying and leaning into the person next to her as she babbled amiably. Inevitably, her ever-present cigarette would tumble from her lips or slip out of her fingers in a shower of glowing ashes, sending the people in her immediate vicinity leaping to their feet and flailing at their clothes. Wanda had platinum blonde hair, and her entrance into Emma's was always accompanied by the playing of "New York, New York," which was her favorite song. Though Emma's was a popular night spot, it fell short of expectations in one respect. It failed to keep Emma off the road. She went right on making appearances from one end of South Georgia to the other, and driving on to Savannah afterward to play until early morning. Occasionally, she spent the night in Joe Odom's carriage house after closing, but most of the time she found an excuse to drive home to Statesboro. On Saturday nights, she would drive home no matter what, because her Sundays in Statesboro started very early and ran very late, as I discovered firsthand. Emma invited me to join her one Sunday at church and stay with her throughout the day. This is how it went. Emma pulled into the parking lot of the First Baptist Church in Statesboro Sunday morning at 8:20. She was wearing a purple silk dress, a blue cape, turquoise eyeshadow, and a touch of rouge.
"Let me see," she said. "We closed Emma's at 3:00 last night, and I got home about 4. I would have pulled off the highway and taken a 15-minute nap under the Ash Branch overpass like I usually do, but there was a big old truck there ahead of me, and it took all the room. So I got to bed by 4:30, and then at 7:15, Aunt Annalise called to make sure I got up in time for church. She's 90.
Emma adjusted the 2 lacquered chopsticks that anchored her bun.
"I can keep going with just a couple of hours of sleep, but sometimes you can tell. My eyes get puffy."
We went inside the church. The preacher delivered a sermon entitled, "Temptation and Decay from Within." A deacon then read a report on the forthcoming revival week, the theme of which was to be, "Wake up, America, God loves you." The deacon thought too many people were still very much asleep in regard to this message.
"There are 180 million people in America who do not claim Christ," he said. 2 million in the state of Georgia. Thousands in Statesboro alone."
The preacher then addressed the gathering.
"Have we got any guests among us today?"
Emma whispered that I should stand up. All heads turned.
"Welcome," the preacher said heartily. "So glad you could join us."
After the service, Emma and I walked to a smaller chapel where the older people were to attend their weekly senior assembly. We were slowed a bit by the dozen or so people who came up to welcome me personally to the church and to ask where I was from.
"New York," a woman said. "My, I had a cousin who went there once."
In the chapel, Emma slipped off her high heels and played the organ as the others came in. Each member of the senior assembly stopped at the organ to greet Emma, and then came over to me to say how pleased they were that I had come. Mr. Granger was the first to address the gathering.
"I tell you, my wife is doing great," he said. "I knew last Sunday it was malignant, but I couldn't tell you because the doctor hadn't confirmed it until Tuesday. I really have a heavy heart, but everything is being taken care of as far as I can tell."
From the rear of the chapel, a woman said, "Ann McCoy is in St. Joseph's Hospital in Savannah. She's having back problems." Another said,
"Sally Powell's sister died."
Mr. Granger asked, "Is there anyone else?"
"Cliff Bradley,"
several people said at once.
"Cliff went home yesterday afternoon late," said Mr. Granger. "He seems to be doing great."
"Goldie Smith needs our prayers," another woman said. "There's something the matter with her stomach. She's being fitted with a prosthesis."
A woman with pink lipstick and gold-rimmed glasses stood up to give a testimonial.
"Me and my family weren't doing too good until I looked down and saw I had a God hole in my chest. We all have a God hole in our chest. You should all do what I did. Turn it over to Jesus."
When the assembly was over, Emma went to a small room off the chapel, where she and a dozen other older women had their Sunday school class. Emma introduced me all over again, and the ladies chirped and mewed little hellos. The leader of the class said she'd give a talk about God's people in a changing world, but did anybody have any important announcements first?
"Myrtle Foster's incision is still draining," said a woman with glasses and a light green suit. "I talked to Rap Nelby last night, and they don't know when she'll be able to come home."
"We'll have to put her on our prayer list," said the leader.
A woman with her hair in rows of small blue-white curls said, "Louise saw Mary at the beauty shop on Friday, and it seems the two others are not doing well either, so we need to keep them on our list, too." For the next few minutes, the health of several other members of the congregation was discussed, and the prayer list grew by three more names. The leader then began her talk. "Jesus will never ask you to do anything he wouldn't do himself." And Emma reached into her pocketbook and took out a small manila envelope with "Emma Kelly, $24, written across the top. She stood up quietly and put the envelope into a carton with the other ladies' envelopes. Then, motioning for me to follow, she tiptoed into the hall with the carton. I felt a tug at my jacket.
"I hope you enjoyed it," a lady by the door whispered. "Come back and see us again."
Emma led the way down the hall.
"Now we go to the little children 2 floors up, she said. First, she went around to a windowless room and handed the carton to 2 men, who were sitting behind a table piled high with little manila envelopes.
"Morning, Miss Emma," they said.
Upstairs, about 20 children were seated in a semicircle around an upright piano, waiting for Emma. She accompanied them as they sang the titles of the books of the New Testament to the tune of Onward Christian Soldiers.
"Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, Acts and the Letters to the Romans."
Then she played "Jesus is a Loving Teacher" all the way through twice.
"We can go now," she said,
and we went back down the 2 flights of stairs and out into the parking lot.
"If the other lady who plays piano can't go to the nursing home, I go there now," said Emma. "But she's there today."
So instead, we drove directly to the Forest Heights Country Club, where Emma went to the buffet, put 2 fried chicken legs on her plate, and sat down at the piano in the dining room. For the next 2.5 hours, she played background music and chatted with the diners who came up one by one or in family groups to greet her and pay their respects. At 2:30, Emma got up from the piano and said her goodbyes. We walked out to the car and drove 50 miles into the bright afternoon sun to Vidalia, home of the sweet Vidalia onion. Emma had been hired to play for a wedding reception at the Serendipity Health and Racket Club. Upon arriving, she went directly to the ladies' room and changed into a flowing black and gold kimono. The owner of the health club, a large lady with a bouffant blonde hairdo, took us on a tour of the spa and showed us the new indoor-outdoor swimming pool and underwater grotto, of which she was very proud. The wedding guests began to arrive from the church, but the bride and groom were late. Word had it that they had stopped at a 7-Eleven to get plastic glasses for the champagne they were consuming in the car. When the wedding couple finally arrived, Emma found out that the name of the groom was Bill, and she announced she had a special song for the occasion. She sang, "Big Bad Bill is Sweet William now. Married life has changed him. He washes dishes, mops the floor." The song was greeted with laughter and set everybody to dancing, except the little boys, who went out and put a bottle of champagne under the hood of the wedding couple's car, next to the engine block, so it'd heat up and explode when they drove away. At 6:30, after Emma had played for 2 hours, we got back into her car for the drive back to Statesboro. If she was tired, she didn't show it. She was not only wide awake, but smiling.
"Someone once wrote that musicians are touched on the shoulder by God," she said, "and I think it's true. You can make other people happy with music, but you can make yourself happy, too. Because of my music, I have never known loneliness and never been depressed. When I was growing up, I used to put the radio under the covers with me at night. That's how I learned so many different songs. In fact, it was because I knew so many songs that I got to know Johnny Mercer in the first place. We met over the telephone 20 years ago. I was playing at a dinner party in Savannah, and a young man kept requesting Johnny Mercer songs. He was kind of surprised when I knew every one.
Then I played some he hadn't heard before, and he was astonished. "I'm Johnny Mercer's nephew," he said. "I want him to meet you. Let's call him now." So he called Bel Air, California, and told Johnny he'd met this lady who knew every song he'd ever written. Then he put me on the phone. Johnny didn't even say hello. He just said, "Sing the first 8 bars of If You Were Mine." Now that's not a well-known song, but it was one that meant a lot to Johnny. I sang it without any hesitation, and we were friends from then on. The sun was beginning to set. "To me, the words are as important as the music," said Emma. "Johnny and I like to compare our favorite phrases. We both loved the lyric, 'Too dear to lose, too sweet to last,' from the song While We're Young, and the line from Handful of Stars that goes, 'Oh, what things unspoken trembled in the air.' Johnny's own lyrics are the best, though. It's hard to think of anything more beautiful than the lyrics to Early Autumn or Summer Wind." It was because of Johnny Mercer that Emma started singing. Until she met him, she played the piano, and that was all. Mercer kept telling her, "Go ahead and sing." But she was afraid. She told him she had no range. "That's all right," he said. "Just sing softly. You don't have to hit every note. Sing low and skip and cheat a lot. If you can't reach it or don't know it, skip it." He showed her how she could change keys instead of going up an octave for the second verse of I Love Paris. He even helped her cheat with one of his own songs. She was having trouble with the line, "I want to be around to pick up the pieces when somebody breaks your heart." She couldn't drop down for the second syllable of somebody. Mercer told her to sing the same note for all 3 syllables. She was still dubious about singing, though. Then, one evening, she started an engagement at the Quality Inn and found a microphone and sound system all set up. "Oh, look," Mercer told her, "you've got a mic. Now you can sing." And she did. Years later, she found out that Mercer had arranged for the mic to be there, and paid for it, too. Emma recalled how over the years she had played piano for plain folks and dignitaries, for 3 presidents, 20 governors, and countless mayors. She had jammed with Tommy Dorsey and accompanied Robert Goulet. She recalled the day, years ago, when piano playing every day of her life had become a necessity. It had happened on a Sunday morning when her youngest son, upset about having broken up with his girlfriend, dropped Emma and her husband at church and then drove into the woods, set a rifle butt against the floorboards, turned the barrel to his chest, and fired. He collapsed on the steering wheel, sounding the horn. Someone heard the horn and came running. The boy lost a lung, but his life was saved, at a cost of $40,000. Emma had to work day and night to pay the bills. The near tragedy only served to intensify her faith. What if the bullet had gone just a fraction of an inch to the left or right? What if he hadn't fallen on the steering wheel? The Lord must have been with him, Emma said. I have to go on believing for that reason alone. Even after she had paid the hospital bills, Emma continued her nightly appearances. It had become her life. We arrived back in Statesboro shortly after 7:30. Before going home, Emma stopped at the home of her 90-year-old aunt to bring her a box of food she had taken with her from the country club. Her aunt came to the door in her nightgown and nightcap. She'd been listening to the radio broadcast of the evening sermon at the Baptist church. Emma went inside for a few minutes and tucked her in bed. Then, more than 12 hours after her day had begun, she drove home. "There's another wonderful thing about being able to play music," she said. "It's something Johnny Mercer told me. He said, when you play songs, you can bring back people's memories of when they fell in love. That's where the power lies." On the basis of attendance alone, Emma's piano bar was an unqualified success.
Financially, however, the bar didn't do very well. Joe's inclination to give people free drinks was one reason. In addition to that, many of Joe's old creditors saw the bar as a chance to recoup some of the money he owed them. They would come in for an hour or so of drinking, and then leave without paying. But even so, Emma's should have made more money than it did. Joe sought the advice of Darlene Poole, who knew the bar business inside out. Darlene had worked as a barmaid in a number of local saloons, and was engaged to the owner of a successful club on the south side. She and Joe sat at a table, having a drink.
"You got a nice setup here," she said. "The Blue Rinse and Foxtrot crowd finally have a place to go. Can't hardly go to the Night Flight. Can't go to Malone's. Can't go to Studebaker's. You got 'em all to yourself, honey. Nice going. Plus, I see you've got Wanda Brooks coming in here. Broads like Wanda are what I call insurance. With her bumping into everybody and knocking drinks over left and right at $3 a shot, you can't help but make it work. Now, if you can just keep the freeloaders out and stop giving away the liquor, you should do all right. Just make sure nobody's glass stays empty too long."
"Maybe that's the problem," said Joe. "Gotta get Moon to pour drinks faster."
"Moon?"
Darlene whirled around and looked toward the bar. Then she looked back at Joe.
"Shit, Joe, you didn't tell me you had Moon Tompkins tendin' bar."
Darlene leaned closer to Joe and lowered her voice.
"Moon's your problem, honey."
"Why do you say that?" Joe asked. "He seems okay to me. Maybe a little slow."
"Moon Tompkins has done 3 years for bank robbery," said Darlene.
Joe laughed. "Yeah, yeah," he said.
"And it wasn't just one bank either, it was two."
"You're serious, aren't you?" said Joe. His laugh turned into a curious smile. He looked toward the bar where Moon Tompkins was pouring vodka into a row of four tall glasses.
"Well, I'll be damned," he said. "I wouldn't have thought old Moon had it in him."
"How in hell did you ever let him in here as bartender?" Darlene asked.
"Emma hired him. I guess he didn't put the bank job on his resume."
Darlene lit a cigarette.
"I suppose you heard about the armed robbery at the Green Parrot restaurant last week?"
"Uh-huh."
"Moon did it."
"Oh, come on," said Joe.
"Are you sure about that?"
"Positive."
"But wait a minute," said Joe.
"How could you know it was Moon? They haven't caught the robber yet."
"I know," said Darlene. "I drove the getaway car."
Joe had nothing against convicted bank robbers, or getaway car drivers either, but he felt foolish entrusting his cash register to a dedicated thief. Moon was using the most rudimentary of all scams, making more drinks than he rang up, and when he did ring up drinks, he often propped the check on the cash register so it hid the numbers.
"You can bet he's pushing the no-sale button whenever he does that," said Darlene. "And slipping $20 in his pocket."
Joe decided that the wisest thing to do would be to catch Moon in the act, confront him quietly, and allow him to quit without a fuss. He wouldn't tell Emma anything about it, because the idea that she had been in business with a bank robber might give her a heart attack. Joe asked two friends to come to the bar the following night and keep careful count of all the drinks Moon served. During the day, however, word leaked out that later that night, Moon Tompkins would be caught with his hand in the till at Emma's, and by the time the bar opened, a festive crowd was clamoring to get in and watch the sting unfold as if it were a sporting event.
"Good gracious, we're having a lively night," said Emma.
Customers ordered drinks at a furious rate, hoping to encourage Moon to steal more than he had ever stolen before. The more drinks they ordered, the merrier the mood became, and by midnight it seemed that Emma and Moon were the only people in the bar who were unaware of the sting in progress. The customers called out their orders.
"Hey, Moon, Give me a stinger. What better drink for a sting than a stinger?
I'll have a Rob Roy, Moon.
A half hour before closing, Moon took the trash barrel out to empty it in the dumpster and never came back. When Joe stepped behind the bar and opened the cash drawer, it was empty. Moon had cleaned it out. Moon's disappearance did nothing to dampen spirits at Emma's. It only served to heighten the level of hilarity. At closing time, there was nothing Joe could do but tell Emma what had happened, that Moon had taken all the money and run.
"My goodness me," said Emma. "Did he really?"
"I'm afraid so," said Joe. "And I guess it's a good thing we're rid of him, because it seems he's done this kind of thing before. He's a bank robber."
"Oh, I know all about that," said Emma.
"You knew?"
"Why, of course," she said. "Moon told me about it when he first came looking for a job. He didn't try to hide it, and I told him I admired him for that. I thought he deserved a second chance in life. I think everybody does, don't you?"
"Yes, ma'am," said Joe. Emma got into her car and then pulled out onto Bay Street, headed for Statesboro. As was his custom at this hour of the morning, Joe led a few friends back to his house, where, according to the fire captain's report later in the day, someone dropped a lighted cigarette into a wastebasket shortly before dawn and caused the fire that nearly gutted the house. Joe was the first to smell the smoke. He ran through the house, rousing people from beds and sofas and herding them into the street. "Is everyone out?" the fire captain asked.
"Everyone I know about," said Joe.
"You mean there might be people in your house you don't know about?"
"Captain," said Joe, "there have been times when there were people in my bed I didn't know about."
It was widely assumed that Joe Odom had set his house on fire to collect the insurance money, even though he no longer owned the house. Joe's landlords asked him to vacate the premises at once, not so much because of the fire, but because Joe had never paid them any rent. A week later, Joe took what furnishings he could salvage and moved into a large federal-style brick townhouse at 101 East Oglethorpe Avenue, a few blocks away. His new next-door neighbors were Mr. and Mrs. Malcolm Bell. Mr. Bell was the retired chairman of the Savannah Bank, former president of the venerable Oglethorpe Club, and a respected historian. Mrs. Bell was an intellectual and a member of a distinguished Savannah family. In view of his august new neighbors, Joe's friends anticipated that life at his new home might perforce be a bit more modulated than it had been at 16 East Jones Street. And perhaps it was. But before long, neighbors began to notice that visitors were passing through the unlocked front door of 101 East Oglethorpe Avenue in a steady stream, that tour buses were pulling up in front at noontime, and that pleasant piano melodies could be heard spilling out of the house day or night, but especially at times when the city was otherwise utterly still. Chapter 7. The Grand Empress of Savannah. An unnatural calm descended over Jones Street after Joe Odom's move to Oglethorpe Avenue. No longer could Joe's sweet serenade be heard floating over the garden walls. In the stillness, it occurred to me that it was time to buy a car. I wanted to see more of the environs of Savannah, but I proceeded carefully in the matter of wheels. Savannians drove fast. They also liked to carry their cocktails with them when they drove. According to the National Institute of Alcoholism and Alcohol Abuse, more than 8% of Savannah's adults were known alcoholics, which may have accounted for the disturbing tendency of motorists to run up over the curb and collide with trees. The trunks of all but one of the 27 oaks that lined the edge of Forsyth Park on Whittaker Street, for instance, had deep scars at fender level. One tree had been hit so many times it had a sizable hollow scooped out of its trunk. The hollow was filled with pea-sized crystals of windshield glass that glittered like a bowl of diamonds. The palm trees in the center of Victory Drive had the same sort of scars, and so did the oaks on Abercorn. I had never owned a car. Living in New York, I hadn't needed one, but the idea appealed to me now. If I was going to drive a car in this environment, though, it would have to be a very big and heavy one. It would probably have fins. "I'm in the market for an old car," I said to Joe. "Something big and roomy, nothing fancy." An hour later, we stood looking at a 1973 Pontiac Grand Prix. Its metallic gold body was dented and flecked with rust. The windshield was cracked, the vinyl roof was peeling, the hubcaps were missing, and the engine was well into its second 100,000 miles. But it ran well enough, and it was big. It didn't have fins, but its hood was so long it looked like the foredeck of an ocean liner. The man was asking $800. "It's perfect," I said. "I'll take it." Now I was completely mobile. I drove south of Gaston Street, breaking Joe's second rule. I took excursions into South Carolina. I sailed past the trees with the scars on them and shared the road with drivers who sipped from traveler cups and lurched from lane to lane. I felt perfectly safe in my rolling metal fortress, rusted and dented as it was. Nothing and no one could get to me, and nothing and no one did, with one very notable exception. Her name was Chablis. When I first laid eyes on her, Chablis was standing by the curb, watching me intently as I parked my car. She had just come out of Dr. Myra Bishop's office, across the street from where I lived. Dr. Bishop was a family practitioner. Most of her patients were conservatively dressed black women. Those whose gaze happened to meet mine usually nodded solemnly and moved on. But not Chablis. She was wearing a loose white cotton blouse, jeans, and white tennis sneakers. Her hair was short, and her skin was a smooth milk chocolate. Her eyes were large and expressive, all the more so because they were staring straight into mine. She had both hands on her hips and a sassy half-smile on her face, as if she'd been waiting for me. I drew up to the curb and rolled to a stop at her feet.
"Ooh, child," she said. "You are right on time, honey."
Her voice crackled, her hoop earrings jangled.
"I am serious, I cannot tell you."
She began moving slowly toward me with an undulating walk. She trailed an index finger sensuously along the fender, feeling the hollow of each and every dent.
"Yes, child, yes, yes, yes."
She walked on past me and continued all the way around the car, inspecting its condition and laughing. When she got back around to me, she leaned in the window.
"Tell me something, honey," she said. "How come a white boy like you is driving a old broken-down jive-ass brother's heap like this, if you don't mind my asking?"
"It's my first car," I said.
"Oh, I hope I didn't hurt your feelings. If I did, I'm sorry. I truly am. I did not mean to do that. I just call it out, baby. Whatever way I see it, I just call it out."
"No, that's okay," I said. "I'm just practicing my driving skills before I go out and buy a Rolls Royce."
"All right, honey, I can dig it. You are traveling in disguise, baby. You are incognito. Yes, I can dig that, child. I surely can. And you know, honey, when you drive a car like this, you don't get nobody fucking with it. Ain't no stereo for nobody to rip off. Ain't no fine paint job for nobody to scratch up with no key, honey."
"That's true, too," I said, opening the door to get out.
Oh, child, don't you be doing that, she said. Don't you be hauling ass with me standing out here like this.
But I live here, I said.
That's okay, baby. You can practice your driving skills some more on the way to taking me home, okay? 'Cause Miss Myra's shots is getting ready to kick in, honey. I can feel 'em. I am serious, and these feet are about wore out.
There seemed to be no doubt in the young woman's mind that I would take her home. I mumbled something on the order of, well, sure, but it was unnecessary, because she was already getting into the car when I did.
I live downtown by Crawford Square, she said. It won't take but a few minutes.
She settled into the seat and looked at me.
Ooh, child, you are some kind of handsome. If my boyfriend wasn't living with me, I would hit on you for sure. I am serious. I like my white boys, and that's what I have plenty of waiting for me at home, thank goodness. My boyfriend is blonde and beautiful. Hunk for days, honey. He satisfies my every need.
We pulled away from the curb.
I'm Chablis, she said.
Chablis? That's pretty, I said. What's your full name?
The Lady Chablis, she said.
She turned sideways in the seat, pulling her knees up and leaning back against the door, as if she were sinking into a luxurious sofa.
It's a stage name, she said. I'm a showgirl.
She was beautiful, seductively beautiful in a streetwise way. Her big eyes sparkled, her skin glowed. A broken incisor tooth punctuated her smile and gave her a naughty look.
I dance, I do lip sync, and I MC, she said. Shit like that. My mama got the name Chablis off a wine bottle. She didn't think it up for me, though. It was supposed to be for my sister. Mama got pregnant when I was 16, and she wanted a little girl. She was going to name her La Quinta Chablis, but then she had a miscarriage. And I said, ooh, Chablis, that's nice. I like that name. And Mama said, then take it, baby. Just call yourself Chablis from now on. So ever since then, I've been Chablis.
A cool white wine for a cool black girl, I said.
Yes, child.
What was your name before that? I asked.
Frank, she said.
We had stopped for the light at Liberty Street. I looked at Chablis again, very carefully this time. She had a small, feminine frame and delicate hands and arms. She carried herself like a woman. There was nothing masculine about her. Her big, dark eyes were watching me.
I told you I could dig being in disguise, she said. I'm in disguise 24 hours a day. I am incognito.
So you're really a man, I said.
No, 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 she said. Don't you be calling me no man. Uh-uh, honey. Your mama worked too hard to grow her titties. She ain't no man.
Chablis unbuttoned her blouse and proudly revealed a medium-sized, perfectly shaped breast.
This is real, honey. It ain't silicone. It's what Dr. Bishop's shots do for me. Miss Myra gives me estrogen shots, female hormones, every 2 weeks, and in between I take estrogen pills. They give me breasts and soften my voice. They slow down the growth of hair on my face. They make my body smooth all over.
Chablis slid her hand from her breast down to her lap.
And my candy shrinks, honey, but I still have it. I ain't having no operation, child. I ain't studying that.
We were now crossing Liberty Street. Chablis's blouse was still wide open, exposing her breast not only to me, but to half a dozen pedestrians. I had no idea how far she intended to go, but I feared the worst. I kept one eye on the traffic, the other on her. The back of my neck began to feel warm.
You don't have to show me your candy, I said. Not here, I mean. I mean not now. Or ever. Chablis laughed.
Oh, I'm embarrassing you. I'm making you all nervous.
No, not really, I said.
Child, don't lie to me. Your face is turning red.
She began to button up her blouse.
But don't worry. I ain't no stripper. At least now I know you ain't gonna be calling me no man.
We pulled into Crawford Square, one of the two squares in Savannah that fell within the black section of town. Of the city's 21 squares, it was one of the smallest and most picturesque. It was surrounded by humble wooden buildings. In its center, instead of a monument or a fountain, there was a small playground. A huge, gnarled live oak spread its branches over a small basketball court where several boys were playing. Chablis pointed to a neatly restored four-story wooden house on the far side of the square.
"Yes, child," she said. "Miss Myra's shots are starting to do their thing. I'm feeling that boost of energy. I'm getting that surge of femininity. Got to go and be with my boyfriend now, 'cause in a couple of hours I'm gonna feel like the bitch of all time. That always happens, too. I get to feeling like the last bitch on earth, and until that passes, I cannot stand to be touched."
Chablis stepped out of the car.
"Thank you for being my chauffeur and everything," she said.
"My pleasure," I said.
"You should come and see the show sometime. I put my face on and I get into my gowns."
"I'd like to see that."
"'Cause right now, you see, I'm just little old Chablis, just a simple girl. But when I get it together, I turn into the Lady Chablis. And I'm good, child, real good. I'm a beauty queen, you know. I've been crowned in 4 beauty pageants. I got titles, lots of 'em. Right now, you are looking at the Grand Empress of Savannah. That's who you had in your car today."
"Well, I'm honored," I said.
"Miss Gay Georgia, too. I won that one also. And Miss Gay Dixieland and Miss Gay World. I've been all of them, honey. I am serious, child."
The Grand Empress turned and ascended the steps of her house. As she did, she put an extra measure of swing in her hips, an extra bounce in her stride. It wasn't until I was halfway home that I realized Chablis had forgotten to tell me where it was she performed her act. If I had put the slightest effort into it, I could have found out. In a town the size of Savannah, there couldn't have been more than a couple of night spots that featured drag shows. But I let it go. Not that Chablis didn't fascinate me. She haunted me. And she was definitely a she, not a he. I felt no tendency to stumble self-consciously over pronouns in her case. She had removed any trace of masculinity, and in that sexual limbo of hers, she was a disturbing presence, one that challenged all the natural responses. A few weeks later, the telephone rang mid-morning.
"Ooh, child, I am some kind of mad at you. You ain't come to see my show."
"Is this Chablis?" I said.
"Yes, honey. I just been to Miss Myra for my feminine booster shot."
"Would you like a ride home?" I asked.
"Well, yes. I guess I done trained you right."
I came downstairs and we got into the car. "I would have come to see you," I said, "but you didn't tell me where you did your show."
"I didn't?" she said. "I'm at the Pickup, honey. That's a gay bar on Congress Street. 3 nights a week. Me and 3 other girls. You may not be into drag shows, but you'll never know the real Chablis till you see me shake my butt and run my mouth up on that stage.
And the way things are going, you ain't gonna get the chance if you wait much longer." "Why not?" I asked.
"'Cause I'm fixin' to read my boss. And I might even do it during the show tonight.
I always say whatever comes into my head, and I never know who or what it's going to be about. Anyhow, my boss ain't on the top of my list right now. Him and me is about to have words.
On the subject of what? I asked.
Money. My salary's $250 a week, but I ain't complaining about that, 'cause it's for only 3 nights' work, and with tips it gives me just enough to live on. But I'm the only one that gets a regular salary. The other girls get $12.50 a show, and that's damn pitiful. Last week, 2 shows had to be canceled when the DJ didn't show up, and we were standing there with our faces all made up and our gowns zipped, and the boss didn't give those girls a dime. Oh, child, he's gonna hear from me.
And when he does?
There's no telling. My ass could be out the door.
What'll you do then?
Make guest appearances. I can get bookings in Atlanta, Jacksonville, Columbia, Mobile, Montgomery, all those places. The South is one big drag show, honey, and they all know the lady. They all know the doll.
Chablis looked coyly at me.
So if I get my ass fired tonight, child, you're gonna have to travel if you want to see me do my shit.
Then I guess I'd better go to the pickup tonight, I said.
I guess you better had, honey.
Chablis touched my arm as we drew up in front of her house.
Look over there, she said. There's something I want to show you.
A young blonde man was leaning under the hood of an old car. He was stripped to the waist. His muscular torso was smudged with grease and glistening with perspiration. 2 boys sat on the curb, watching him work on the car.
That's my boyfriend, said Chablis. That's Jeff. He's the hunk I told you about. Come, I want you to meet him.
This, then, was the one who, as Chablis had put it, satisfied her every need. It was hard to imagine exactly what those needs might be, harder still to envision what sort of person would satisfy them. Yet, apparently, here he was. By all outward appearances, he was normal, even wholesome. He broke into a broad grin when he saw Chablis.
I think the trouble's in the alternator, sugar, he said.
He wiped his hands on his pants.
I'll get it working somehow, and then we can take a spin.
Chablis hooked a finger through his belt and pulled him toward her. She kissed his neck.
It's okay if you can't fix it, baby, she said. We got us a new chauffeur and limo. Say hello.
Jeff smiled. Hey, he said, extending his hand.
You better watch yourself, or Chablis is liable to start running your life, too. But I guess worse things could happen to you.
He slipped his arm around Chablis' waist. Chablis put her chin on his shoulder and looked into his blue eyes.
You ready for lunch, baby?
She said. Jeff cupped his hand around her buttock and squeezed it.
I already ate, he said.
She leaned into his body.
You know you ain't done eating yet, baby.
Soon as I get this engine running, I'll come in. I promise.
You go ahead.
Chablis turned away with a mock pout.
My engine's already running, baby, but that's okay. You go play with your car. I'll be having lunch with my new chauffeur.
She linked her arm in mine.
Come on, child. Keep me company.
I was so taken by the situation at this point that I couldn't muster even a polite refusal. I gave in at once, and in a few moments we were sitting in Chablis' living room, having a plate of tuna salad and a glass of Coca-Cola. The apartment was light and airy and comfortably furnished. The front windows looked out through the foliage of a magnificent oak into the square. There were 2 matador prints on the wall, a shag rug on the floor, and an Aretha Franklin record playing softly on the stereo. From the sofa where she sat, Chablis could look out a side window
and see Jeff working on the car in the street below.
"My baby treats me like a goddess," she said. "He leaves little notes all over the house saying how much he loves me. And I tell you, he is some kind of good up under them covers. The man is out to please, honey, and he does just that to the doll."
Chablis stirred the ice in her Coke with her finger.
"He's straight, you know. He's not gay. He attracts both men and women, but he's only into women. Of course, my friends say, 'Well, how can he be straight if he goes with you?' And I say, 'As long as I'm getting my fair share, I ain't gonna be asking why.'"
She took a sip of her Coke and licked her lips.
"What sort of men do you attract?" I asked.
"That depends what's going on with me and my hormone shots. I've gone on them and off them, and they make a big difference. When I'm on them, I attract very masculine men. Men with girlfriends, men with wives and children. When I go off them for a while, my masculinity comes back a little and I get to feeling like a tomboy. That's when I attract the gays. Parts of me get excited that usually don't. When I'm in my tomboy mood, watch out, 'cause I play with everybody, even the nelliest fags. If I think they're cute, I'm gonna tease and everything.
There are times when I can be really butch."
As she said this, Chablis leaned forward and put her elbows on her knees. The cadence in her voice became more clipped, and the muscles in her face tightened. She moved her head and shoulders now with the jauntiness of a boxer. For the first time, the boy inside of her came to the surface.
"But then I go back to Miss Myra, honey," she said, "and I get a hormone refill. I become feminine again, and I attract the masculine men."
She settled back into the sofa. The lines in her face softened as I watched, and her body became languid again. The boy vanished. Chablis was Chablis again. She smiled.
"I don't overdo the hormones," she said. "When I get too much of them, I don't climax. So I get off them every now and then just to relieve the tension. I don't like to be lifeless down there. I take just enough hormones to give me that feminine glow and keep a chest on me."
Chablis went into the bedroom and came back carrying a black dress and a cigar box full of bugle beads.
"You don't mind if I do a little sewing, do you, honey?"
She threaded a short string of beads and stitched it to the dress.
"A girl's got a sparkle."
She shook the dress. Hundreds of bugle beads swayed and glittered. She strung some more beads, then looked up from her threading.
"Ever put on a dress?"
"No," I said.
"Never even wanted to?"
"No."
"Well, honey, I never wanted to wear anything else. I've been into women's clothes so long, I have no idea what men's size I am. I'm serious. I gave up on men's clothes when I was 16. I started putting on makeup and wearing little earrings to school and slacks and blouses. For me, it was the natural thing to do. I was always effeminate, and I was always called a sissy or a fag or a girl, so I didn't feel I had anything to hide. And I just liked girls' clothes."
"How did your family take all this?" I asked.
"My father and my mother were divorced when I was 5. I grew up with my mother, and I would visit my father up north every summer. He hated the way I was. His whole side of the family hated me. When he died, I went to his funeral in a dress, and I had this gorgeous white boy on my arm. They were appalled, honey. They were horrified, especially my aunt. She started in on me at the funeral in front of everybody, and I told her to get out of my face or I'd say something about her own son she might not want to hear. So I stay away from that side of the family, honey. I don't clientele with them."
"Clientele?"
"Yeah, I don't have anything to do with them. I don't mess with them. Mama's different, though. She has a big old photograph of me being crowned Miss World, and it's hanging in her living room. She taught me not to worry about things that don't matter. She has a motto that I love. 2 tears in a bucket, motherfuck it. That's Mama. She's a okay girl.
Chablis turned up the sound on Aretha Franklin and held the dress up to herself as she stood before a full-length mirror. She churned her hips in time to the music. The beads bounced.
Yes, honey. When the drums roll, the bugle beads flow. Look at them beads, baby. Flawless.
She turned toward me again.
You sure you never wanted to put on a dress?
Yes, I'm sure, I said.
What makes you think I would? Oh, nothing.
But you never can tell. That much I've learned, honey. I used to go to straight parties in Atlanta. They'd pay me $100. I'd be announced at the door, you know, as Tina Turner or Donna Summer, and then I'd mix with the guests. Everybody knew I was really a drag queen. But I'd look like Tina or Donna, because I'd be wearing a wig. I'd talk like Chablis, though, and I'd have a good time, and so would they. Anyway, these gorgeous macho men would come up to me and ask for my phone number, and, ooh, I'd go home all excited. Then a couple of days later, they'd call for a date. Well, honey, come to find out, most of them really wanted me to dress them up in pantyhose and walk all over them in high-heeled shoes. So you never can tell, child. You never know. When I see a gorgeous hunk, honey, I don't assume nothing. More men are into dresses than you think. Us up front drag queens is just the tip of the iceberg. Just the teeniest tip.
Do you ever feel like going out in the street in a suit and tie? I asked. Just for the hell of it.
If I went out without my drag, honey, those rednecks would clock me for the big sissy I am and kick my ass. I am serious. I'd be more paranoid out of drag than in it. But there's something else that does worry me. Here in Savannah, I mean. Know what it is? Walking down the street as a couple with a white boy. That makes me paranoid in Savannah.
Don't you ever date blacks? Don't you ever go to black bars?
No, no, no. I don't go up in there, child. That's something your mama don't play.
Uh-uh. I don't play up in them black bars, baby.
Black boys will hit on you just like that the minute you walk in. They try to make a move on you and hey mama you and honey you to death. I don't play that. Black boys are so aggressive, honey. It's nothing for them to come up and start touching you and hitting on you and stuff, even if you're with somebody. Oh, I know black boys have their points, honey. I had a white roommate in Atlanta once, a real girl, and she loved black men. You know how those white girls get when they get a piece of black dick, honey. Black dick will wear you out. It will make you want to write all your checks.
Chablis stitched a string of beads onto the dress.
That's just another reason I like my white boys, she said. Plus, when black boys find out my tea, honey, they be ready to kick my ass.
Your tea?
Yeah, my tea. My thing, my business, what's going on in my life.
You mean you've dated guys without telling them about yourself?
Yes, honey! And when they find out, they either kick my ass or they want to love me. They reach down there to feel something soft and wet, and they feel something else that ain't so soft and ain't so wet. Know what I mean?
Then what happens?
One black guy put a gun to my head. We'd partied for hours, and he'd spent lots of money on me and showed me off to all his friends and everything. At the end of the night, we went home and was lying in bed, just hugging and kissing, fully clothed, and he kept wanting to touch me down there. And I kept saying, no, no, no. And he kept saying, why won't you let me touch you down there? And I said, I promise you, you don't want to be touching me down there, child. And we went back to hugging and kissing again. And then he finally caught me off guard and touched me down there.
and before I knew it, he pulled a gun and put it to my head. He said, I'll kill you, you son of a bitch. I'll fucking blow your damn brains out. You made a big fool of me.